Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 806. This is going to be a very, very, very quick intro. I just want to quickly say that I'm going to be on tour on the East Coast in a bunch of cities the beginning of June for like the first 8 days in June. Go to ID10T.com. That's ID10T.com, ID10T.com. And come out and see me if you're in one of the areas around there. This episode is Colin Farrell. Colin's promoting The Lobster, which is... The movie's fucking amazing. It is completely different than anything you've ever seen, and he's fantastic in it, and everyone's fantastic in it. Legitimately fantastic. I'm sure if you've seen any reviews, then you know I'm not bullshitting you. The movie's fucking great. John C. Reilly's in it. There's a lot of really great people in it, and you should go see it when you can, like now. Well, after the podcast. Or actually, start the podcast, drive to the theater, finish the podcast, go in and see The Lobster. Here's the Nerdist Podcast number 806 with Colin Farrell. Katie, please roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
When it ends, then you'll just be able to watch it all at once. You won't have to wait.
Yeah, binge watching. I'm quite excited about that. Did I binge watch? How many shows do you have to watch a night to consider a binge?
I think just a couple.
Okay, so I binge watched Mr. Robot.
Oh, isn't that great?
Yeah, it was great.
I mean, in the first five seconds of the show,
so
you're,
good.
You're
that
in.
Guy, so good in it.
What do you think's going on that show?
What do I think's going on?
Yeah.
Oh, God, a whole lot. It's just too, there's too much. It's too chaotic to try and find some kind of clear idea of what the narrative is telling you.
I think there's gonna. The next season's gonna have some weird sci-fi.
It was all a dream. Bobby Ewing's still alive. It's all just a dream.
The power of Dallas still pervading.
Still pervading. Fucking John C. Reilly turned up for the press today in like a 10-gallon hat. He looked like J.R. He did. And I mean, in a great way.
Yeah, but you said John C. Reilly is a guy that could. John C. Reilly could ride in on a giraffe and people would be like, yeah, it's John C.
Yeah,
Reilly.
He's great, man. He's great. He's so. Yeah, he's lovely.
He's great in the movie, too. And you're fucking fantastic in this movie.
Thanks, man.
This movie is so great.
I hope we're recording. Are we?
Yeah,
this happening
recording.
Already? Good. Excellent.
Cut all this.
Sorry, I missed that last bit you said.
It's really.
Thank you.
It's really great because it when you finally see something that is so completely original and it's done well, it's such a, because you know you sit through so many other movies just waiting for something really fantastic. I mean, this movie's fantastic like from second one.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, Yorgos is something else. Yorgos and his co-writer Efthymios Philippou are pretty special fellas. You know, the perspective they have on life and how the sense of humor that they have and how they see all the things that we all feel and all observe in what we esteem at times are the mundanity of our days, and they see it and they put it in a really spectacular kind of context and vessel, as they did in, I mean, you know, what is Dogtooth, his I think his second Greek film, was an exploration of what? I don't know. It's set within the structure of a family environment, a very, very suppressive family environment. So it is about family dynamics, but then Alps is about, you know, just to put a byline, I'm sure they're all about much more, but it's about grief and the ability or disability of human beings to really deal with grief and move on from the loss of loved ones. And then this one is about, I don't know what, 1001 things. You know, there's not, you were asking me what happens at the end of the film, and I wasn't being facetious when I said, you know, as much as I, because it's more than any other film I've done. I don't claim any ownership of what it's about or even what my character's journey is. There's no arc to my character. You know, there's usually arcs. A character arc. He starts here. He goes on some heroic journey, or he learns some great life lesson. Not really with David. He's just, you know, he's just bumbling through like so many of the characters are under this very, very oppressive kind of regime to try and just exist, really.
I do think there's... It just sort of read a lot about the sort of... crazy pressure of relationships and not feeling like not a part of a relationship, you're broken. And if you're broken, you got to live in the woods, you know?
Yeah,
but
then
they have their own set of rules too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's in there as well. I mean, the film is, you know, there's 1001 contradictions in it as well. You know, I could see people thinking that the film has a political bent to it also, because, you know, there are two kind of conflicting ideologies that are at play, and both are very extremely drawn.
Sure.
And one is the ideology of the hotel, where if you're single in this world, you have to go to the hotel where you have 45 days to find a partner. And the finding of a partner, or the aligning with another person, is usually dictated by sharing some common physical characteristic, whether it's short-sightedness or a limp. But if you don't find a partner within 40 days of the hotel, 45 days, you get taken to the transformation room and you get turned into an animal of your choosing. Meanwhile, there are a group of people who are kind of anarchic by nature, who live in the forest, and they're called loners, and they have shunned the rule of society, which is this rule that singledom is against the law of the land, and they live a life in the forest alone. They meet together every now and then to dance to electronic dance music and partake in other such kind of odd activities in the middle of a forest in the dark. But there are really strict and really sinister rules that are at play there. Like, if you're caught flirting with someone, you're given the red kiss, which is your lips are cut with a razor blade and you're forced to kiss the person you were flirting with. So you just go from one extreme to the other. And I don't think this is the filmmaker's intention, but me as a layman, I see it. I read the script and I read it as an observer, as just a fan of writing. And then I do the film as an actor, and then I see the film. Because it's so unusual, my presence doesn't ruin the whole spectacle for me like it usually does, because it's so particular.
Right.
So I see the film as a viewer as well, and as an audience member, and I garner certain relevances or certain kind of allegorical lines drawn between what's in the film and the society that we live in. And one of them that I draw is that any kind of rule of the land that is strident and is, by its very nature, oppressive against human nature, is inevitably bound to fail. Our people will have to push against it and have to kind of, you know, try to seek out some form of individual existence.
I love anything. It's very, I mean, and I know he's Greek, but it feels like a British movie, because it's so, anytime there's dialogue that's like, I love the dialogue of inane, literal small talk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Would you like to shine your shoes? No, I shined my shoes yesterday. Okay, I was just asking. You know, it's that there's, no matter which side of the fence everyone's on, there's still this kind of like mundane existence, and everyone's just trying to hobble through as best as they can.
Yeah, absolutely. There's plenty of that in there. Absolutely.
So yeah,
no meaning beneath the lines.
No, but that's what's great about them.
It's beautiful. There's a great freedom and a complete lack of subtext. Certainly for my character, anyway, there was no hidden meaning. Whatever he said was whatever he was feeling, and he wasn't feeling much at many times.
So is there a tone meeting before you start something like that? Because you obviously have to trust a director when you're there.
Yeah.
And you're like, are you sure this is what you want?
No, the tone meeting was kind of sitting in a dark theater 5 years ago watching Dogtooth in Philadelphia on a Tuesday night. That was the tone
meeting.
Just
getting it.
Yeah,
going, okay,
well, you just kind of go, okay, so you see Dogtooth and you see Alps and you go, here's a filmmaker with a very particular cinematic language that he has at his disposal, or that he's creating, you know, between him, as I said, and Evthemis, his co-writer. And I think Yorgos was kind of adamant is the word, or was kind of hopeful that any of the actors that he spoke to had seen and were versed in his previous works.
Right.
Because he knows himself. I don't know if he thinks he's brilliant or shit or what the hell his creative inner voice is. But I know that he understands that he's a very specific way of making films, both the process of making them and also a very specific tone that he's reaching for. And that tone is allowed to change, and it's allowed to reveal itself to Yorgos and to the cast and to the crew in the process of shooting the film, and then re-reveal itself in his process of cutting the film and of putting music. This was the first time I think he used music. There wasn't music in Dogtooth and Alps. But yeah, Yorgos he's very aware that his voice is kind of a very singular voice in film.
Yeah.
Which you're aware of when you read the script. I mean, you don't, because you don't read scripts like this. I mean, you just don't. I've been reading scripts for 15 years now, and, you know, I may read anywhere between 20 and 50 scripts a year or something, and every now and then you come across, as I said, a voice that just, they are using language that we recognize and language that we have at our disposal. They are using emotions to greater or lesser degrees and thought patterns to later greater or lesser degrees, but there's some way that all these things come together that makes it incredibly unique. And I felt the same when I read Martin McDonagh for the first time, and I felt the same when I read York's stuff for the first time, and Terrence Malick. You know, I mean, even greats like Peter Weir. They have a very, Peter has a very particular cinematic language, which is akin in my book to kind of David Lean. It's very particular, but these guys are writers first and foremost, I think, you know.
Yeah.
Particularly Martin, I mean, he's a writer to his core and then got into filmmaking. But yeah, the worlds they design on the page and then bring to life through the process of shooting is so, so unusual and so specific.
And sometimes people who are hardcore writers first, especially if they're novelists, and they go, it can be a little constricting because they're so powerful at constructing their world.
Yeah, and they've heard it.
Yeah.
And they know how they want it to sound.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, I mean, poor Martin, I love him, but he's a bee's dick away from giving you line reading. I mean, at any given moment, you know what I mean? Because Martin, here's the, you know, there's almost an iambic pentameter to the way he writes, and there's such a music to his language. Whereas with Yorgos and Evthemis, it's not so much that there's a music to their language. Of course, there is a kind of a stilted fluidity. You know, anything that works has to have a fluidity, but this is a very stilted one. It works, and it works awkwardly.
Yeah.
And that's the purpose of it, I believe. But it's as much, if not more, about the worlds they create and the dynamic that goes on between the characters rather than exactly what they're saying at any given time.
And I love a movie that just establishes a world without having to go, here's why this world is the way it is. Like, it just is the world.
No, he's got enormous...
It's just the world.
It's funny because, you know, I know that... I would assume that Yorgos has been accused of being pretentious and shit, you know? I mean, it's, you know, or his work being highbrow or exclusive or something like that. But I swear I don't know of a director I've worked with that has a greater respect for the audience and for allowing the audience to have their own experience. He's not trying to impose his own personal philosophies and ideologies on the audience. He is setting up a very specific world, but leaving so many things open to interpretation, as evidenced by particularly the end of... Did you see Dogtooth?
I did not see Dogtooth.
Check it out. So good. I mean, so fucking disturbing. Jesus.
I know. Well, that's the...
I mean, it makes Lobster look like Mary Poppins. Do you know what I mean? It's so bleak. Like, at least there's a little bit of love on the fringes of the story.
Sure.
I think by the end of The Lobster, you know, there's a sweetness that begins to kind of make itself through struggle apparent, or that it wants to be in the story through Rachel's character, my character. But Dogtooth is just, it's just bleak. But yeah, what was I saying? I can't remember.
Well, you were talking about you said there was some fringe hope in this movie, but the other one was very dark. But maybe it's just about the way writers kind of convey.
Oh,
the
yeah,
world.
No, I was saying about his respect for the audience. Yorgos's respect for the audience. It really, he is so adamant that he, even as a filmmaker, as a director, does not have any definitive answers for what exactly each moment in the film is about. He knows what he finds true, and he knows what he finds intriguing, and he knows what he finds essentially interesting in human behavior and in regard to the, you know, the societal systems that we all live within, whether it's the first, you know, societal system most of us grow up in is a family, and then it goes into school, and then it branches out into neighborhood, and then if you travel for college, or you can say world, it goes out like that way. And Yorgos finds all that stuff really interesting, but never at the expense of the audience's involvement. He's not just making something for his own fancy. He's really, really more concerned with asking the question in an interesting way than answering it in a kind of a feat of perceived self-certainty.
Well, there's definitely the movie keeps weaving back and forth between hilarious and human, and then something super fucked up.
Yeah, no, really.
Just like quick super fucked up where you're like, what the? Yeah. Oh, God. And then back into the...
Yeah, I mean, any film that can take a common kitchen appliance... as this one does, such as a toaster, and use it in the way this one does. You go, it's fucking mental. And then you just think, what's around the corner? Everything. There's nothing really, you know, there's nothing as seemingly in my mind. I think of a toaster and I think of, oh, you know, nice cup of tea and a couple of pieces of toast, lashings of Kerrygold on it, and good comfort food and nice hangover cure. And like a toaster is something that it's like pajamas, you know, but then in this film you see it in the way that's used and it's like, Jesus Christ, this world is really twisted.
It's an evil weapon. It was
yeah,
temporary.
Yeah, horrible.
It was horrible weapon that he was being punished for.
It was almost like they were using it like that's what the toaster was invented for. The rest of humanity have been way off the mark for all these years putting bread inside it, but it was actually supposed to be human.
Ultimately, the movie is about unpacking the true nature of the toaster.
Yeah, exactly.
That should be the
tagline. That should be on the one sheet. Have the one sheets all been printed up? Is it too late?
Can we throw that in? Are you guys? Can we make a call? Should we call someone? You can call someone. But you mentioned Martin McDonagh, and I'm sure people shout this at your face all the time, but In Bruges is one of the most beautiful movies. I mean, it is such a...
Nobody has ever shouted at me at that.
But that's also the thing, heckle you. In Bruges is a beautiful cinematic experience. Yeah.
No, it's fuck you, Farrell. Asshole.
Oh, do you get that?
I want my money back for... Name a film.
Name a film. People don't shout at you on the street.
Nah. People are pretty good to me, especially when I go home. That's one of the great pleasant surprises of the last 15 years. Nobody's ever thrown a punch at me in Dublin. I thought that had happened for some reason. I thought just for years somebody would try and be well.
Oh, you think you're special, do you? Bam, bam, bam.
A bit of that, yeah.
But nothing.
No, I love going home and everyone's lovely.
Do you feel like they kind of keep you tethered to what?
I mean, I'd like to think I don't need to be tethered, you know? I would like to think, and maybe I'm full of shit, but I would like to think the things that are really important in life outside of all this. I mean, this is, telling stories and you know, involving yourself with one of the most grandiose forms of make-believe known to man is gravy as a living. You know what I mean? Even when it's not working out for you, or you're doing things that you do something that you don't believe was realized in the way that you thought it may have been when you initially set out to do it. And even if, you know, basically if you do something that you think doesn't work and you know you're not alone in that thought, even then it's an amazing way to make a living. And I love it. But it's not really, you know, it's not the thing, you know. The thing is the other stuff, you know, and it provides an ability to take care of some of the other stuff. But so with regards to being tethered, I mean, I just, you know, the things that ground me are not how I'm perceived as an actor or perceived even as a man by strangers. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, it does affect me at times if I read negative shit and something catches my eye, and
sure,
it sucks. But there's been plenty of that. I've had plenty of experiences with that. But the bottom line is, it's about those that you have close to you in your life and how they perceive you based on what they know about you. You know,
yeah. And you honestly, you're able to. Kind of, because I don't think you're on. Mm. You're not on, like, on social media or anything.
No.
Yeah. That's probably why you're.
I'm better at distancing myself from public responses, you know, than I was at the start. I mean, at the start, I just loved getting on and Googling myself and seeing what he was saying.
I feel like people learn pretty
torture,
quickly.
You know, torture. But you know what it asks you to do? It literally, being in the public eye, especially with social media being as prevalent as it is today, and what it basically asks you to do, and excuse me for my self-interest and involvement, is pass by a locker room and hear somebody say, "Chris Horrock," and it asks you to keep walking.
And not investigate.
Keep fucking walking. Don't go back and see what the end of the sentence is. And that's what, because you know there's dialogue, you know, you don't have to be a big head to know there could be people talking about your comments on pages or pictures at any given time. So it is a tricky thing. It just plays into human fears. And am I accepted? And am I, you know, it's as simple as that. I'm much better at it. I have no interest in it now because it's just tiring. Any reason why you get on to look at that shit will never result in you coming away feeling good about it.
No,
anything.
Because even if it's positive, it doesn't do anything.
You're not getting on to see positive stuff.
Right.
If you needed to see positive stuff, you wouldn't get on.
Right.
You just wouldn't get, like, the people that can go online to read comments on themselves and not be scarred by it, sadly, are the people that don't go online.
That's right.
Like, those that want to are the ones that really can't, that shouldn't. And
I mean, it's a very interesting time, and I always wonder how, you know, people, like, if you were a film star in the 70s, I feel like it'd be pretty easy to just not ever be affected by any of it, because you would never know. But
yeah,
so...
and I'm not into you know, I mean, I truly, there's no, it's interesting, because there's this culture of distrust or culture of, you know, just within the world of fame and all that kind of stuff, where it's kind of like, you know, fuck famous people, life is so easy and all that stuff. And I get it, because I don't think that anyone by virtue of fame or recognizability or by virtue of wealth or even by virtue of what they may be able to do, unless there is some kind of musical genius that they have, that they can create a great sense of peace or a great sense of community with people all over the world. But I don't think it essentially makes them better people,
right.
Certainly not the presence of fame. I mean,
right.
That's nonsense. But at the same time, then, if you get frustrated with that and you go the other side, then it can engender in those who are watching from the outside looking in a kind of an anger that's not really about the famous people
of
either.
Course.
It's just an expression of frustration that's born of wherever a person's life may be at the time.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's a funny thing, the whole, you know, comment sections, and It's just a funny thing, because back in the day when freedom of speech was coined, of course, you had to be responsible for every word you said.
And now you don't.
You had to be across the table, like you and me are sitting now, and really be accountable, and now you don't. You hide behind, you know, Blue Faffer 49. And
I know this sounds weird, but I have this collection of antique guns from the like the 17th and 18th century. I don't know why. I don't have a justification for it. I just think they're pretty.
It sounds weird as having to sit in a room with two microphones and talk to each other, and other people are going to hear it. That's weird.
I guess it is weird.
That's not weird.
The guns don't operate or anything. They're just old. But when you're kind of looking at antique gun sites and you see dueling pistols and you realize, oh yeah, the things that someone says online, a tenth of the ferocity of that a couple hundred years ago, you'd be out in a town square pacing and shooting a tiny ball into someone's spine.
The glove would be off, the slap would be had, and it'd be back to back and 10 paces.
Seriously. Words had so much power, and that's how interesting it is that our culture has flipped, that there's such an ambivalent. Like, words don't really mean anything anymore.
I know, swear to God, man, I wish everyone the best. I just have a suspicion that the majority, if not every single person that gets on and writes vitriol online, is a miserable bastard.
I mean, it's quite possible.
You know, and I just wish that there was less miserable bastards in the world. So it's not about, why did you say that? It's kind of like, oh God, you're in pain.
Why can't you?
Like, yeah, no, seriously.
I hope something good happens.
Come on, pick up the mirror. Close the screen. Pick up the mirror.
Live your life. Yeah, come on. Enjoy your life. Enjoy your life a little bit. But I think it is about finding that, because it's, particularly performers, I would imagine that most performers crave a bit of attention when you're young.
For sure. Oh my God.
You get attention when you're performing and people are, oh, that's great. And so there is something that you're trying to fill.
Yeah, absolutely.
But all the superficial stuff that I think you think is going to be the thing that fills it doesn't really fill it.
No, nothing does. Nothing really. There's no amount of adoration. There's no amount of affirmation that can come your way from the outside world that will ever really answer the true questions that exist, I think, within all of us that, are born of our fundamental apple in the garden question of what's it all about? Why am I here? What is my self-worth?
Sure.
And for sure, acting initially for me and doing acting workshops, there was a couple of things that happened. Number one, I thought, great to be in front of people and have attention, and great to feel for a minute popular, and great to all that kind of stuff. And then you start going to theater school and that shit goes away pretty quick because you've got 8-hour days, 5 days a week, and your teacher's telling you your shit and all that kind of stuff. So that goes away, and then what it was replaced by was just a curiosity, a natural curiosity that I had in the machinations of human behavior and just why people interact the way people interact, and why I or my brother, my sisters, my mother, my friends feel the way we do, and how our feelings result in the accumulation of certain behaviors which become habit, which become personality, and blah blah blah. So that was kind of, and that's kind of what's sustained me. All the other stuff, I had a kind of a fast meteoric mental rise when I came over to America first when I was 22 or 3. I did a film called Tigerland.
It just went mad. Yeah,
it went so, and it happened so fast that I kind of lost the joy in it. And I feel that's something that's kind of, for me, just personally returned selfishly in the last, maybe 4, 5, 6 years or so.
Kind of a fucked up thing to happen to a 22-year-old who is...
It's a lot. It's not poor me. It's never, I'm sorry, anyone that wants to slag me, you can fuck off. I'm not saying life was hard. I'm not. There was no starvation. There was no sickness.
It fucks with your head.
No, I'm just saying, for the human psyche and for the emotional development of a young man who is already probably, underdeveloped at 23, it's a lot. We are assisted by those who are around us in our lives from our youngest ages on, our family, our schools, or we're assisted or we're hindered, but we're deeply affected. And we're also given a set of rules, and it's not just rules that are represented by the laws that are written, but social rules, things that are okay, things that are not okay, behaviors that are appropriate, behaviors that are inappropriate. I don't agree with what one person says is appropriate across the board. I don't agree with another person says is inappropriate across the board. You have your own room for individualism there, but there are certain things that you're told are kind of cool. Well, if you get a certain amount of fame, you're kind of told you can pretty much do anything.
Yeah.
Like anything, which is a shocking, which is can be great fun, folks at home, don't get me wrong, can be great fun, but can also land you in a shitload of trouble. And can also, you know, just the bridle can come off and you can just lose yourself in it all because you just don't know. And then you have people around you that are there for the good time and then you're constantly pushing and then boundaries just cease to exist. And, you know, it's amazing. Like, it's a very thin line between complete freedom and absolute self-imposed incarceration, you know?
Yeah, well, I think humans really do need a certain amount of structure. Yeah. And I think they need to feel connected and they need to – and so when you take away the boundaries, I think people start pushing boundaries because they're just looking for boundaries. And it's like, oh, there aren't any. Yeah. So how do I keep – upping this and they get,
someone stop me. Someone show me real love. Say no. You know?
But you're famous. I know. Stop it, please. Yeah.
No, I needed a louder no at 25 than I did at five or six years of age, you know? Seriously. But I had lots of fun. It was an incredible time. My point being is this, it's a load to try and process, that's all. And I had a lot of family around me and people that cared for me, so I never really had a posse or an entourage, but I would actually get away from my family because I knew that they had my best interests at heart, you know, as much as I could. But I'm glad that chapter is closed.
So what advice do you have for people that maybe are trying to find that self-worth in the external world? Or how do you tell people? I don't know, but you're older and wiser now.
I'm older for sure. I don't know about wiser, but yeah, yeah, you know, it's tricky, man. It's tricky. Even as, you know, you and I sit across and you're wearing a beautiful black suit and a black tie.
I just got off work. Otherwise, I'd be like T-shirt. I'd have a Star Wars T-shirt on.
Hollywood Studios on wherever we are, Sunset Hollywood Boulevard, and life is good. And it's still just tricky enough to be a sentient human being and wonder where you fit in the grand scheme of things. You know, are you a good lover? Are you a good dad? Are you a good husband? Are you a good friend? Are you honest? Are you worth something? Are you capable? Are you smart? Are you handsome? Are you pretty? All this stuff that we put so much worth in, and none of it means anything because none of it's coming with us. The only thing that really, for me, has to mean, you know, like health and not even health sometimes, because there's plenty of people that have health and they don't even realize that, and I myself include a bitch about life and I'm like really healthy, and then I meet someone whose health is suffering and this has happened, and they have some fucking philosopher's stone, they've unlocked some key that means they can see through the strictness and the kind of debilitation of whatever sickness they're going through at the time is, and yet they have some deep joy, which is just maddening and brilliant and beautiful to see. But so what's the secret? I have no idea, man. I just know that all the things that are supposed to be the things are not the things. I can tell you what it's not about much quicker than I can tell you what it is about.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the best thing about fame. The best thing about it is that you get to strike something that a lot of people would say would result in their happiness.
Yeah.
Off the list.
Yeah.
You really get to practically. And then you get to go, okay, but it's actually really cool because it allows me to provide, and then I can get good tickets to this or good seats to that, or, you know, the odd time you find yourself in a private jet that you're not paying for. And, you know, see, then you can really kind of giddily enjoy all the trappings and the good things that come with it and just have fun with it and not put too much importance in it.
Or at least raise awareness if there are social causes that you raise awareness more than you'd be able to.
Absolutely.
And I mean,
That's a very real aspect of it.
I think that there definitely is a responsible way to do it, but it is odd. It is an odd thing. And I'm not 100% sure it was ever necessarily whatever sort of intention the universe may or may not have had for humanity. I don't know if like a handful of people rising up above everyone else for attention. It kind of feels natural, but weirdly unnatural at the same time.
You know, you've heard the saying, if you meet Buddha on the path, kill him. You know, but it's about that. It's like any time you think you have found something that has the answer, or, you know, any time you find something that holds itself aloft, there's a really high probability that that thing will be either as a result of your own perception or just the facts of its existence will be a delusion and will be something that is there to trick you.
Yeah, and of course, again, if people listen, they're like, well, it's easy for these guys because they have the money. But I do want to say it's not – none of that stuff makes everything.
No, I don't know if I'm a good father or I'm fucking my kids' lives up daily. I mean, that's all I'm talking about. That's the important stuff. I'm not even trying to normalize myself or anything. I'm just saying, you know, it's amazing that through the chaos and you know, extremity of situations that I found myself in the last 15 years, that it's just really nice to arrive at a place where I realize how confused I am just about the simple and important shit. You know, and that no amount of fame or money can sort the most important fundamental things out in your life.
How do you make sure your kids listen, that they're safe, and there's nothing that you can, you just have to figure that out.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Just failing.
I'm nervous. I'm, you know,
have you got kids?
I'm not yet, but I'm getting married in August, and we'll definitely.
You were going to say I'm getting one.
I'm getting one.
Where are you going?
I'm going to find one.
Amazon.
I'm going to go to the Amazon and find a child. No, but my fiance wants to have kids in like a year, and
I meant Amazon.com, of course. Amazon.com. For anyone out there that's thinking that I was suggesting you go to South
Amazon
America
Prime
and purchase.
Will have him in a day. No, yeah, Amazon Prime will have that kid in a day, and a drone will drop him off in my house or her. Either way,
so dangerous,
it's
but
really
effective
dangerous.
And speedy.
It's very fast. You can have anything. It is. We live like fucking kings. Like we,
I know,
it's like bring me.
It's insane.
A million.
Yeah,
bring
exactly.
Me 10 of those things.
Yeah, it's only a matter of time before you can literally Amazon one grape.
That's it.
Just a single grape in bubble wrap.
But I'm definitely. We're gonna have kids soonish, and
cool,
and of course,
man.
And I'm terrified. I am terrified of it. So okay, good.
It's so much fun.
Everyone says that, but I'm such
it's
a.
Also torture. No, it's not. I mean,
I'm a worrier.
It's crazy. It's so mad. So mad. It's like all of a sudden you have these appendages that are part of your body and are attached to and fed by your heart, and yet you can't control them. It's bizarre.
And that part is scary, the not being able to control, just like letting stuff happen.
Yeah, it's both so deep inside you and so far away from your control, you know.
Do you read about like, oh, I should do this, and if I accept these rules, they will have these psychological effects?
No, I've read a couple of things and disagreed with a few things, and then I have some friends that are parents, and we kind of bounce ideas around. You know, it's so much trial and error. But I have two really happy boys, you know, who are complicated fellas. They really are. Oh man, and you know, and you can't get them to talk if you know, because I'm like. Daddy talk. You can tell me anything. Let's talk feelings and emotions and shit that I didn't have the opportunity to, because I think that's the way. And sometimes, guess what? They just don't want to do it. It's like, no, my emotional life is my emotional life. They don't say that. Was kind of, can we stop talking about this now?
Right.
That's what I get sometimes from a 6-year-old. Can we stop talking about this now? And this is two lines into the conversation. And both lines have been questions from me. So, you know, seriously.
I was wondering if, can we stop? Yeah. Okay, I didn't, yeah. Okay.
I was literally driving down the street one day and I looked in the back of the, yeah, I looked in the rearview mirror and one of my boys was looking out the window, and he looked very kind of wistful and a little bit melancholy to me. And of course, I had to fucking interrupt the moment and go, are you okay, little man? And he stopped looking at the window and he went, yeah, why? Why did you ask that? And I just thought to myself, oh, you dick, Carl. I said, nothing. I said, you just were looking at the, you know what? Nothing. Sorry. You could keep looking out the window. And, you know, he was having his own. So you just worry. You want to know what your child's thinking, your children
sure.
are thinking and feeling. Of course, it's completely natural, but they're amazing things for me.
Yeah. I mean, I still remember what it was like to think my parents didn't know anything, even though now I know that I don't know anything and they were really smart, you know, like, but I remember when they would say stuff and be like, You didn't even know. But of course, looking back, of course they knew.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, my dad still didn't know shit. God bless him. I love him. If he's listening to this, it's all good. Love you, Dad. But I remember my old man asking me to listen to lyrics and songs and stuff, and just drive the idea of it, listen to words in songs.
What songs?
I mean, one of his favorites was My Way. Oh no, and also Fairy Tale in New York.
Yeah.
Which is a great tune, of course, a great tune. But that line, I could have been someone, well, so could anyone. He used to play that particular line. I just feel like, what are you trying to say? Yes, 8 years of age. What are you trying to say?
My
like,
and my way
even
too.
Even if I make it, I'm just like everyone else, or are you trying to say it is a good thing that I can do something special with my life, but I shouldn't identify with that too much? Or what are you trying to say? I wasn't thinking that at 8, of course.
Can we not talk about this, please? And then
yeah,
you just
yeah, exactly.
Do that.
I'm just going to stare out the window again, like my future son in 36 years, who I'll interrupt and ruin the moment for. But however, it's fine. Move on.
But I think it's good to... I think learning, you know, I feel like so much of our lives, especially now, when so much feels uncontrollable, we're in this really insane political climate, we're in this really insane global climate,
yeah.
You know, the everyone has a voice, and the internet, the stuff we were talking about, everything feels so uncontrollable. So how do you, how do you kind of harness that and create a protective bubble for, you know, these little beings that are being introduced into a completely fucking bonkers world?
Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes you can overextend yourself, and the nature of protection or the nature of reaching out and trying to provide a, you know, a safe haven for somebody can also jeopardize, I think. I think there's a certain amount of, obviously, freedom. You know, this is a country that espouses such, you know, rampant philosophies about freedom and liberty. And I think that's very important to a certain extent to pay your kids as well, and to allow them to, that old thing about make their own mistakes and so on and so forth. I was just going to think of something there in reference to that, but I've also come back to it. But in reference to
giving your kids freedom, not protecting them too much.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was thinking there was a moment about 4 or 5 months ago, and I was with my youngest boy, Henry, who was, or maybe he was five. It was nearly a year ago, and we were coming out of Gelson's, I think, and I was holding his hand, and I saw two paparazzi just across the car park, which is fine. You know, they used to drive me mad, but I did a little bit of work on that as well. And they're not. I mean, I don't love what they do and anything, but I don't let them spoil me day.
That's good.
Yeah, because you can easily do it. I swear to God, you go, next thing you're in a foot race, or you're, you know, trying to get through red lights or do donuts, and it's 2 hours and you're driving around and you're going, what the fuck am I doing?
Life and is they want precious. That too.
Oh, of course, you know. But anyway, God bless me, each of your own. You never know what another man's been through unless you walk a mile in the shoes, of course. Anyway, so I came out of Gelson's. I had my little boy by the hand, saw the two paparazzi. I picked up my little fella. And I started running and pressing the thing for the beep beep for the car, and the tension in my body was completely processed by him. And we got to the car and opened the door, and he went, "Daddy," because I was running. He's like, "Daddy, what's wrong? Why are we? What's happening?" And I put him in the car. And I said, "Nothing, little man. Nothing." And I put the belt around him in the car seat, and I closed the door. And I got into the car, and for a second, I was like, "Well, yeah, I don't think they got many pictures." And then I was like, "What the fuck am I doing?" He had no idea.
Right.
That little fella had no idea.
He just thought you lost it for a second.
He just had no, yeah. I just made him really, really anxious. For what? For my own notion of principles and my own, you know, natural enough desire to protect my child from something that I philosophically or ideologically don't really agree with.
Right.
So you have to be careful, you know. I think I think a lot of the times we try to protect our kids from things that we know are harmful, and that can engender a fear in us, and we can kind of preemptively defend, which is not always wrong either. You know, you see a child walk towards a fire, yes, preemptively defend and put your hand out, don't let it get burned first. But there are times as well when we just, I know for myself, I can put too much of my own shit on my kids. It's never in the form of a belt,
right?
You know, or switch. It's not my thing.
At least you're aware of that, though. Like, most people aren't even aware of
no,
that.
No, I'm so aware of how much I'm fucking up as a father.
I don't think you're so fucking aware.
No, but
it does sound like you do. I could just, even the way that you're explaining, I can see your wheels spin. Like,
yeah,
you really do think things through.
It's really interesting, yeah, because I know how, you know, well, I know. Oh, sorry, I have an idea of how sensitive I was as a kid, and you know, you don't have to be getting a knuckle sandwich from your father for stuff to hurt you in a way that it kind of
sure
congeals within you and comes out in some kind of maybe poor choice that doesn't best serve you on the playground or later
right
on in life, even, or you know. So without being a robot and trying to break everything down, you know, you have to chill out as well.
just have a good time.
And that's what it's all about. That's what this is all about, I suppose. Life is trying to, you know, trying to extend and trying to, you know, multiply the times of joy and peace and laughter and try and, you know, allow naturally or through a discourse with the self a diminishing of all the other agitations.
It is, and you know, and sometimes the discourse with self is a challenging part.
Yeah.
You know, how many... So I do feel like a lot of it is about asking good questions.
Yeah, for sure.
Like asking good questions.
Yeah,
how can
sure
I be, not why did I fuck this up, but how can I be better? What did I learn from this?
Moment? Absolutely.
It's not always easy to extrapolate those lessons.
No. But it can be fun as well, you know?
It can be.
For $200 an hour. No.
But I mean, it's also, I think sometimes it's really important to just like write shit down.
Mm-hmm.
To just see it.
Do you journal or do you keep a diary? Do you mess around or just little bits of ideas? Or what
I mean, I'm going to, yeah, I use... I mean, I'm a comedian, so I have a note program and I write, you know, like I don't sit down and go, this morning I had bacon for breakfast, you know, but it's just like weird, you know, I have a folder that's all these kind of like weird ideas that I don't know what to do with.
Sure.
And I just get them out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And some of those turn into comedy and some of those just exist for nothing.
And have you written short stories or have you thought of writing a novel or would you like to do that as well or no, down the road or script, film script?
That stuff, it's, you know, I don't mind that. You know, I like the writing process, but it's I don't like the editing process. That fucking drives me nuts. And I feel like that's why I wasn't necessarily meant to be a screenwriter, because if I didn't...
Wait, you don't like the idea of somebody else editing your own work, or you don't like the idea yourself of having to mean your own work by cut it down and form it?
I wrote a book a few years ago that was a little more autobiographical, and I wrote the first draft in a few months, and I'm like, I did it! And they came back with all these red marks. I'm like, God damn it, now I have to think about what I wrote?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It's like, how do you...
You just didn't accept me.
Yeah. So that's all the part. I don't know. Are you writing stuff at the moment?
No, I mess around and write like bad poems and stuff, but I enjoy them. And no, there's an idea I have for a script that I want to write, and I've started a few scripts over the years, but I'm crap with follow through. I'm so impatient, you know. So I've started a few things and not finished them. But there's one thing that I literally started in 2011, and I just came across it. And it was only the three scenes that opened it up, and I kind of remember where it was going. And I'm in a different place now, which is really interesting to apply wherever I am now to what was a genesis, you know, 5 years ago. But I'll finish that. I know I can do that. Pretty, I have it all kind of, the trajectory of it all blocked out. So I'll just write that and then just put myself under no pressure to even make it.
Yeah,
just go, actually, just as an experience to just actually complete a script for once,
just to see what it's like.
Just to see what it's like to complete a script for once. Just that.
That's the best. I mean, that just doing it for the process is really,
yeah. Just take
the
pressure
off.
No, I'd like to do that, so I'll do that and see what happens. And then I can tell if it was something that would ever be worth putting on film or microchip, that it would be done for, you know, $2 or $3 million or something.
But the great thing is, if you don't feel like doing that, you don't have. You can just do it for that reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you knew this or even cared, but George Lucas, after he sold all of Star Wars and Lucasfilm and everything, he basically just set aside a chunk of money and he's just going to make movies
for fun
that he's not going to show to anyone.
Wow.
At all, just for himself.
Wow.
And kind of feel like, wow, that's amazing, you know.
I mean, it's one thing splashing a bit of paint on a canvas and going, nobody needs to see that, but holy shit, that's amazing.
He's been adamant about, like, so you're going to have small screenings? No, I'm not going to show it to anybody.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe he's just gotten very shy in his old age.
It's possible. Or maybe it's just, you know, at a certain point.
There's a purity to that.
There's a purity. And also, like, maybe I don't, you know, especially for something that he created, a property that he does not, well, he literally doesn't own it, but also socially he didn't really, you don't really own that stuff once it's out in the world.
Yeah.
So there's something kind of gratifying about it. I'm just doing this to do it and I own it and no one else gets it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, would you ever work on something if you thought, like, no one's ever going to see this. This is just for me or this is just for us.
Well, I have worked on a few things that nobody's ever really seen, but I didn't go into it with that in mind. So I can't say I was that kind of, you know, altruistic to the self. But would I? That nobody was going to see?
Yeah, if someone said, there's this thing, and, you know, you're going to work on it for a couple months, it's going to take your time, it's going to take your energy, no one will ever be able to see it. Would you do it knowing that it was just for you and the people who made it?
I don't think so, because I think I'm part, just from where I've come from, I'm part of the experience of telling stories that are supposed to be shared, whether they're supposed to offer a moment's escapism and entertainment, or something like The Lobster, which is a little bit maybe more thought-provoking and has some kind of, you know, maybe social significance if people want to draw that. And a couple of my friends who saw it stayed with them and they did kind of draw some significance of their own lives. But I don't think so. I can't think why I would do that apart from the fun of it. But it would have to be, there'd have to be a particular reason to do it. Like George Lucas is doing it. I think it's very astute what you just said. It makes sense to me whether that's the reason or not. It does that. It was so put out in the public domain. Like it had a reverberation and still has a reverberation, Star Wars, like nothing before or since. So what's the complete other end of the spectrum to that is to go, I'm now just personalizing. I'm now just making about me and my artistic voice just for the fun of it.
Yeah.
Whereas I haven't had that journey. So I just make films and I hope, you know, people go and see them and can relate to the odd frame inherent, you know, therein.
Do you have emotional experiences as you're doing them, or is it kind of a work? Because again, I have to bring up In Bruges again, because it is one of those movies. It's a movie that I feel like you could watch every year or two and go, God damn it.
Right.
They just did it so well. I mean, it's such a... It really just feels like a perfect little movie.
It'd be lovely if it stood the test of time. Again, that's ego bullshit, but it'd be nice if it stood the test
of time. Did it feel that way when you were...
No, not at all. I mean, I loved the script when I read the script. Chris was extraordinary, and it was so... I mean, people have said The Lobster's funny, and some people have said it's a dark comedy, surrealist comedy, and I get that, but it was more funny when it was brought to life. And when I saw the space that the film was set in, and I saw the costumes of the men and the costumes of the women, and I was aware of the situations as they were being brought to life in the scenes, and I saw the other actors bringing their characters to life, and some of it was hilarious. But in reading the script, there was kind of a darkness and a twistedness to it that rendered it not, you know, incredibly comedic to me. That was The Lobster.
Right.
But in Bruges, when I read it, it was hilarious, and it was also deeply upsetting and deeply moving, and it had its own version of kind of existential philosophy that was swimming around in the mix as well. But shooting it, I didn't know. I just knew it was a very extraordinary piece of writing. I mean, I knew it was such an extraordinary piece of writing, I tried to talk Martin McDonagh out of casting me. You know, I
said, really?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Sometimes I wonder how much I'm bullshitting or am I trying to embellishing the past. And so I asked him that, and he said, no, you did. He said, when we met first, you said you should really cast someone else because people will come into the cinema with a certain amount of baggage.
Sure.
With me.
Sure.
And it's such good writing that you should cast an unknown. And thankfully, he didn't listen to me. And
that's good. Hopefully that taught you a lesson about that maybe you're too aware of stuff nonsense. And you're not necessarily
shut
right.
Up, Farrell. Yeah. Yeah, keep your, you know, humility, whether it's true or pseudo, intact, in check, and shut up. I had no idea. But it's one of the films that a lot of people... are a lot of the few people that come up and say it's a favorite of people's.
Yeah.
Film.
Yeah. And I actually really loved the Fright Night remake.
Oh, thanks,
which,
man.
You know, Fright Night,
that
if you...
I don't hear very often.
Really?
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you... You know, it was an interesting movie to... It was an interesting movie to...
Shut up. Anyone listening, I'm not denigrating myself. I'm completely cool with all that I'm saying. This is not... I have not got a cat of nine tails. And I just haven't heard that very often.
And you're not flagellating yourself?
No, I'm not flagellating myself.
No, not at all.
No, not at all. That's cool.
Yeah, well, because Fright Night, if you were a horror fan at all, I loved the original. It was just a weird little movie that I think did well enough that people at the time were kind of aware of it, but it wasn't a huge...
The original? No, it wasn't huge, but it was kind of the definition of something that generated a cult gathering, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
I loved the original Fright Night.
Yeah.
Loved it. And I had a really good time doing the second one. It was good. It was good camp fun.
Yeah, well, because you put your own spin on it, and you were great in it, and Tennant is amazing. You know,
yeah,
David Tennant's great.
Yeah, I think Craig Gillespie did great with that film. Yeah, my friend Craig. I think he did great.
I mean, when you're presented with stuff, and you said you read 20 or 50 scripts a year, what does something have to have for you to go, is there a specific thing? Or
no,
you just...
not really. I mean, ideally, again, like with In Bruges or The Lobster, maybe even Neil Jordan's Ondine, which anyway... something specific, you know, just a voice, you know, as vague as that sounds, just a voice, just a perspective. And I am contradicting myself because I said Yorgos is someone who's, you know, as meticulous and particular as he is as a filmmaker, I've never seen anyone go through such lengths and be so detailed to then offer it open to the audience to have their own interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's amazing. And that's kind of what you're looking for in the writing as well. Something that's specific, something that has an opinion that you might not even agree with, you know, but something that something that resonates with you. And, you know, sometimes you fly through a script and it takes 40, 45 minutes. And that's a really fast read. And then sometimes it's a slog and you have to put it down after 30 pages. And then something happens on the 50th page. And, you know, sometimes you don't believe in the story so much, but the character's dialogue is fantastic and you wish the story held up better or the story was worthy of the dialogue. Other times, you know, the story is really beautiful and it's something that's not original, but somehow the writer crafted it in a way that seems unique, but the dialogue sucks. And so you never know. But usually I find, for me, there's a time about 10 or 15 or pages in or so where my lips almost start moving while I'm reading the part that's been either offered or that I'm being thought of for.
Yeah.
Like, I literally know as my lips start moving as I'm reading that character's dialogue. I might not be saying the words, but, and that means that I'm kind of, there's something that's pulling me into it.
Oh, that's great. Are you, your birthday soon, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, May 31st.
What are you going to do? Are you gonna
I don't know, man. I don't know yet. 40. How old are you? A gentleman should never ask.
44.
44.
Yeah.
You're good for that.
Look at this gray.
No.
Look at this gray.
Same
just
here.
Ripping through
no,
here.
No, you're doing good, man.
I don't know, man. I see it. You know, I see in the mirror. I go, oh, yeah. There it is.
You're doing good.
You know, when I get out of bed, and I'm like, I'm sore for no reason. There it is. You know, here's the gray. But
I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah, did you freak out about it, or are you cool with it?
No, I'm cool.
Oh, see, that's great.
Yeah, I'm cool. Did you when you turned 40?
People
are asking me about it in a way that I feel like I should be freaking out.
No, you shouldn't. You know, that's us putting shit on you.
Yeah.
When I was 38, I freaked out. 40 didn't bother me.
38, when you turned 38?
When I turned 30, I was like,
why? What happened?
40, it's right there. Yeah. It was like that.
I mean, I can get the wheelies by going, you know, in 10 years I'm 50. That's a bit scarier than in 3 weeks I'm 40.
But you know, honestly, it doesn't really bother me. I'll be 45 in November, and
we're
it doesn't
all
even
be fucking dead in 50
years. Of course.
We're lucky, so whatever.
It doesn't. It doesn't matter. Like it. There's
sad life, isn't it? It's very so impermanent, man. It's so quick.
It is impermanent, but it's also permanent. It is permanent though. In the sense
how you live on the memories you
that's
live
exactly
on other people.
Right.
Yeah,
that's exactly
well, that's
right.
Kind of the equivalent of, you know, our an interpretation of heaven, I suppose, is how you live on in the memories of those who were ever touched by you or loved you, you know?
Absolutely. And just that sort of emotional DNA that's passed down.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, so that someday your son will look in the back and be like, what are you doing? Hey, I'm having a moment. You know, like,
there's something
that's really charming and sweet about that, you know? Because it comes from a good
place. My son will say to his, listen to these lyrics. listen to the words.
You don't even know. Your kids don't even know.
Like, well, I'm not even speaking yet. Fuck you.
But that I think that is ultimately what it's about, and I think that's part of, you know, being a part of a community and being connected to the world in a way that's because it's very easy to get completely myopic and self focused, you know. But I can't imagine. I'm never happiest when I'm super self-focused and no one benefits from that. So it's learning how to let go of that.
No, absolutely. And it's like that line and it's like that not that line, but that thing that the character in Into the Wild etches into the piece of wood at the end of his life, at the end of the film, at the end of his life. And I paraphrase, but it's something along the lines of you're not supposed to do it alone. I mean, he has broken free of the constraints of society to go and find himself into the wilderness of, was it Alaska?
I think so, yeah.
And then he ends up, you know, getting very sick and that thing that he etched in was so sad that he finally found the truth that it's not about being alone, it is about being part of a community. And when I talk at all about, you know, looking into the self or spending time with yourself, it's ultimately to better serve your own honesty and thereby better serve your community.
Sure.
And better serve your kids and better serve your parents or your friends or whatever the hell, you know. It's fascinating.
Do you meditate and focus? And do you
wish. I've gone through little periods.
Yeah.
You?
I feel like
little periods. I can never seem to get more than 2 weeks, and then I literally forget. I get tired and I forget, and I was like, oh, back to one. It's like AA, you know, 20 years sober, and then you have one drink, and you're like, oh, I've got one day sober. It's back to scratch.
Oh.
You know, the meditation thing. It seems to be something that works. You know,
that's funny. That's funny that you say that because I'm 13 years sober, and I tried to go to AA at first, and then every time I went, I just got more depressed than when I got there. And so I kind of had to do it with a therapist and a close group of friends.
And you got your own sober system going.
Yeah.
Same here. I mean, I did. AA is extraordinary. I mean, I think it's an amazing thing. And
I do too.
I really do.
Even though I couldn't do it.
Yeah, same here. No, I don't think it's for everyone.
No.
And I did 6 months, you know, of it, and it was great. It was really great. And then, as you said, got my own system in place of, But that, you know, meditation, I know that I should do more of it.
Well, I feel like I feel like there's a, you know what it is as I'm starting to get older and I see dudes who are maybe like 10 years older and I see how stress has kind of affected their bodies and I go, fuck, I don't, it's not going to get better if I don't figure out how to let stuff go. Or
how do you switch off, man? How do you find, where do you find relaxation?
It's really funny you ask that question because I had a day last week that, and normally I'm okay with it, but I had a day last week where I was just like this.
You jacked.
And I never miss drinking at all, ever.
His hands shook violently, by the way. For all you people listening and wondering.
This is shaking. But there was one day where I was like, oh, right, this is why people do stuff like that to unwind their brains. And I came home. My fiance is amazing. She sensed that I was really tense. I was like, I'm sorry. I'm just in a weird space. She kind of gave me space, and I just kind of zoned out for an hour and allowed myself to feel it. I think that was the key, was that I didn't fight it. I was like, I don't feel good. I'm going to let myself not feel good.
Did you just stare into space, or did you read? I stared at
a Nintendo 3DS, and I played a very insipid game that's repetitive. And
good, that wasn't too challenging.
Wasn't too challenging.
Fire off the synapse in your brain too aggressively.
Nope, and it just sort of, you know, and I breathed, but I think when you try to control it is when you get really fucked up.
Yeah,
you're trying to control it too much. You got to let it go.
Big time life in general.
Yes.
Let it go.
I'm not saying I'm good at it, but I'm just saying.
No, me neither, man. Are you kidding me? No, these are all just theories and shooting the breeze and hopes, if anything, you know, just say yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it is, you know, I think, like I said earlier, because the world seems so uncontrollable and because so many people are doing whatever they can to get a foothold, I feel like it is probably one of the most anxious periods in human history because there's so much to process at all times. So, so you asked that question, how do you let it go? I think
the world is moving so fast and intellect is so capable of discerning and breaking down and you know, algorithms exist everywhere. And yet, I think the emotional lifespan of a human being moves at the same pace.
Right. But I think there's also
a disparity there.
I think there's also this idea that, you know, we should never feel a bad emotion at any time. And I think it's important to let yourself feel like if your body's trying to process something, or you got to let it happen. And I think that's how I kind of unwind. It's just like, hey, if I'm sad, I'll cry. If I'm mad, I'll just be like, grr.
That's cool, man. That's being kind to yourself. That's all right. Genuinely, you know, if I could teach my kids one thing, it might be something in the ballpark of what you just said. You know, whatever you feel in life, whatever it is, whether it's anger, rage, hurt, upset, jealousy, greed, envy, joy, all of it, they're all just signals and they're all okay. And don't judge any of them and just allow them their passage through you and, you know, mosey on your way.
Are you good at it? Are you good at kind of, how do you decompress?
I mean, you know, we used to decompress a similar way.
Yeah.
I haven't got that anymore. I'm all right at it. You know, I'm better than decompression now. Doesn't kind of, you know, speed me toward a potentially swifter death than it once did. You know, I mean, decompressing now is like a hike up in the hills, or do a yoga class, or read a bit, or play a bit of the guitar, or, you know, have a coffee and a whatever and a stroll, or drive around town. You know, watch a movie. All simple stuff like that. Yeah. Simple stuff.
Well, it learning how to be okay with just this, you know, I always refer to it as this like straight line, the straight emotional line, as opposed to this crazy parabolic.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm up now. Now I'm down.
Yeah.
I'm up. I'm feeling. I'm alive. You know, it's just absolutely. Like just being okay.
No, the pendulum doesn't swing as far and wide as it once did, but it still swings. There's still music in the old chain, you know?
Yeah. I don't regret that I did it. I think it's good to have experienced it. I think it creates wisdom. And listen, whatever mistakes we make, ultimately, when we're older and wiser, we became that person because of the mistakes we made.
For sure.
It's okay.
Absolutely.
So we gotta let kids do the same.
Can you and me have a hug now?
We gotta hug it out. This is such a hug. This is our hug moment. Hey guys, just open the window and just feel the vibe, and
yeah, exactly.
And don't let anyone tell you what are you doing. But this was also, you've provided our American, a largely American audience with a bee's dick away from, which is a great measurement of length from what
it
you
is,
said earlier.
Yeah,
in the,
if you want to get micro.
If you which I feel like is something that people are going to start using now.
I hope so,
thanks
man.
To you.
That was why I came here today.
You know, it's... The I feel like your accent in particular makes everything okay. You could say anything and our ears would be like, whatever it is, I'm on board.
Do you think?
Absolutely.
Used to be a lot stronger. Used to be a lot
when you
stronger.
Go home and they're like, what happened?
There's certain words that are used commonly at home that if I even say those words, I'll instantly go back to sounding more Irish. And if I go home a couple of days at home and my accent thickens right up.
You're just right back up again. Yeah. Well, you got to be a chameleon sometimes and you got to, you know, like you absorb.
Yeah. No, I think I've held on to it. Yeah.
It sounds Irish to me. I don't know. How does an American accent sound to you?
Like an American accent. Just, which one, you know? I mean, there's so many in Ireland. I mean, Ireland is a small island. What is it? It's maybe 180 or 230 miles east to west, and then a little bit longer, maybe 300 plus, 350 north to south. It's small. But there's a plethora of accents on that island alone. In America, I mean, the accents in this country are just so, so wide-ranging. You know, from Louisiana to Texas to, you know, the Midwest, and New York, Chicago... I couldn't tell you what a San Francisco accent is. An LA accent, I don't know either. But
LA accent is a bit like this. Everyone speaks up at the end.
Yeah.
Everything sounds like a question because I'm afraid and I don't know if what I'm saying is accurate.
I can't really be sure
of anything. Like that's sort of what it is. It's almost not. It's almost more of an emotional affectation than it is like a specific.
Yeah.
Because there aren't that many people who are actually from Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's not entrenched in like the, you know, the hard-boiled times of a particular socioeconomic demographic.
No.
It didn't come through the Dust Bowl.
Yeah. And San Francisco is somewhat similar, but it sounds more like this. L.A. is dumb. Like, they just hate L.A.
Really?
Yeah. It's everything of that. But L.A. is dumb. Yeah, so that's our weird rivalry. But, I mean, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you. We've been talking for an hour.
Have we really?
Yes.
I don't feel like that at all,
it,
man.
It flew by, yeah. Wow. Look at that. An hour and 2 minutes. The Lobster is fucking fantastic, and people should absolutely see it. But just, yeah. But I would also say go into it with an open mind.
Yeah, open mind. It's not everyone's cup of tea. I mean, it's probably not what you should say when you're trying to sell your movie. But
but I think it's a fair...
My bonus is in the corner with her head and her hands going, God.
It's a fair thing to say.
It's not everyone's cup of tea. And anyone that sees the trailer is going to know that. But it's a film that I strongly believe in. And I can seldom say that. like, strongly believe, you know. And I have my friends at home. Some of them loved it. And some of them kind of were scratching their heads going, when are you doing SWAT 2? That's all I mean. All I mean is, look... A film that costs $3 or $4 million to make is never going to be everybody's cup of tea.
Right.
Like a Marvel film is. And by the way, I love Marvel films. That's not a slag on Marvel. That's all I'm saying. Danica, my darling publicist, in the corner going, Jesus, shut him up. Turn the microphone off.
She's got one of the tranquilizer guns from the movie.
You should have cut it off in an hour.
Down goes Colin.
God damn. It was the third hour, the 63rd minute that it all went past.
You know, it is, but it is. It's interesting to see. It's really nice. And I think it's comforting for people, too. Because, you know, people see you in movies like, oh, Colin Farrell, he's got everything, you know. But just hearing how complex and human you are, I think is nice for people. It just makes people feel connected in a way.
Oh, I'm a very lucky fella. They're right. I have a lot, you know. But yeah.
Were you raised Irish Catholic?
I was raised, yes, under that. I was banner of guilt and remorse, and
I had a therapist once who was a comedian before she became a therapist, and she told me this really great joke that two Irish Catholics are watching the most beautiful sunset they've ever seen.
Oh, I love it already.
It was the most stunning, you know, like the sun just painted the sky and this gorgeous.
I mean, that's a joke already. Irish climate, but go on.
Just painted the sky this gorgeous palette of colors, and they sat there silent for a second. Then one turned to the other and said, oh, we're going to pay for this one.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you can never...
Half empty, man.
Yeah.
When's the other foot going to land? Yeah, big time. A lot of that.
But that's not true.
Sometimes the sun shines for a long time, you know? You know the whole saying, and it could have been coined in my country, which I love so dearly, I don't know, but make hay while the sun shines.
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of fear in that saying.
You know? Mean it's like it's going to go down?
Yeah.
It's going to be over.
While the sun shines, you know? Get it in while you can.
Yeah.
You know? And for such phrases can lead people to betray themselves sometimes and betray what they need in a moment, you know.
Well, make hay when you can and enjoy the haymaking process or have fun.
Exactly.
But thank you so much for coming on, Colin. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you,
Chris.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.